Welcome to another episode of the Oncology On The Go podcast. I'm your host, Roman Fabricator. In this episode of Oncology On The Go, Nathan Goodyear, an integrative medicine physician at the Williams Cancer Institute, discussed key clinical efficacy and safety thresholds that integrative oncologists use for flagship integrative therapies, emerging localized and combinatory immunotherapy options for this clinical landscape, and a focus on reestablishing trust through patient-doctor relationships. What are the key criteria or clinical thresholds that lead you to recommend discontinuation or dose reduction of an integrative therapy due to potential adverse effects, particularly in frail, comorbid, or heavily pretreated patients?
The way to start answering that is, first, being in the integrative oncology space, we must always lead with the science. With that, in the conventional oncology space, they've set a lot of the parameters that help guide us in adverse effect, outcomes, all of these things. And so it's not just enough to know the science, but we must contribute to the science. So in that, everything we do must be scientific. It must be evidence-based. And so obviously, clinical assessment, laboratory, but then we follow the criteria both before and during treatment related to performance status scale. We follow that very intimately through this process, because I think that's something that so many have not followed on. Because hey, if you're able to lead to partial response, complete response, but then quality of life goes up, all right, now you've got something where patients are healing and their quality of life is improving. And what we've had over the past is not a lot of look at quality of life. And what's interesting is now patients are saying, I won't sacrifice quality of life for treatment. So we have to meet both. So patients, as a consumer, are driving that. But at the same time, the adverse events, the common terminology criteria for adverse events, we use those to follow through treatment. When you look at the scientific process, you have to say, okay, we have great advancement there. We don't have to recreate the wheel. Let's work with our colleagues in the conventional space, and let's speak that common language, and let's build bridges to help patients. Not only are we seeing little to no adverse events, we're seeing basically these patients get better where there's no treatment options available, and it's their quality of life is not being negatively impacted really at all, which is going to meet now what consumers are demanding, which is targeted treatment, precision targeting, personalized treatment, yet quality of life is not compromised.
Given the personalized nature of integrative care, what steps does Williams Cancer Institute take to standardize the reporting of patient outcomes and adverse effects in a way that is comparable to data generated in conventional oncology clinical trials?
We're wrapping up retrospective data mining of our patients for fecal transplantation. We have a phase two study now open in the United States with prostate cancer that the US FDA fast-tracked from the phase one done here in Mexico. We have other phase one studies ongoing in Mexico, which is OFIPRIS, the Mexican version or arm that is comparable to the FDA. So in essence, We're not just knowing the science and applying it for patients, we're engaged in elevating the science as well. So the way I look at the Williams Cancer Institute, what we do is we have three arms. It's innovate, elevate, and empower. We treat patients with the future of cancer care today. The innovation is on the research side. So building out a research arm to what we do at the Williams Cancer Institute, allowing us to take that innovation that goes through the scientific process, right, open for debate and discourse in the public arena, to then engage to help more doctors help more patients, but then we got to teach. So there's really the clinical aspect of treatment, there's a research aspect, and then there is the teaching aspect, all of that geared to innovate, elevate, and empower not just what we do for patients and not just what patients' immune system do, but what other doctors can do to help their patients. And we'll use those same quantification measurements in those studies. And so that's what we do. Of course, we follow labs, we follow imaging. For example, on the imaging, the way we follow that is with the RECIST, which is the response evaluation criterion solid tumors. And that's where we're actually gauging the response of the tumors to the treatment. So it's not something that's just arbitrary, we think. No. It has strict criteria that has been recognized internationally about how to gauge the response of these solid tumors to treatment.
How do you see localized and combinatory immunotherapy options emerging in the clinical landscape, and what clinical trials should oncologists be looking out for?
We are at the cusp of massive changes in how cancer is approached in a super exciting way. It benefits those in the integrative oncology space, but it benefits those in the conventional oncology space. And so that's why I'm so excited, because I think we're going to build bridges. I think one area to look at is simply the combination of PEF plus intratumoral immunotherapy. That combination is so critical because there are people advocating for systemic immunotherapy. But what we know about systemic immunotherapy as it relates to systemic chemotherapy, the estimates based on published studies is only about 0.5 to 2%. Approximately 1% reaches the tumor. Okay, what if there's a large tumor burden? What if there's multiple tumors? There's multiple mechanisms by which dilution, degradation, barriers, and even the liver uptake. So basically the toxicity with systemic therapy is built in because the liver and the healthy tissue preferentially uptakes all of this systemically delivered therapy, and most of it never reaches the tumor. But the assumption we make is flawed, is that, well, once it reaches the tumor, that 1%, right, it penetrates, it goes to work, and it does the job. No. We now know within that arena of the tumor microenvironment, there are at least currently recognized three tumor immune microenvironments. There is the inflamed environment. That means the immune cells are there. They're active. They're targeting the tumor, and they're creating an immune response. However, within that context, there is the issue of inhibition, immune cell exhaustion, particularly T cell exhaustion, NK cell as well, and suppression. All of that can happen. So it's a restraining issue, but the immune system's there. And so if we can activate the immune system more, get away from the suppression, get away from the inhibition, and reverse the exhaustion, we can engage that immune system to do better. But the majority are what's called immune excluded. It means the immune cells are on the periphery, the boundary of the tumor, but they never get in. So they can't engage with the tumor. They're present, but they're outside. They don't get in. So in that aspect, giving systemic delivery, it doesn't get in. And so the immune system doesn't engage at all. And so it's not the issue of the agents employed. The issue is actually the delivery method employed that's flawed. And by going into the tumor with PEF and intratumoral immunotherapy, we completely bypass that, recruit the immune system right in there and activate it. So we take an immune excluded and now make it inflamed and steer it. And then the other category, though, a smaller one, about 25%, is called an immune desert, meaning the immune system doesn't even know the tumor's there. There's no immune cells that have been sensed or primed to even see it. So what we have to do is recognize we don't want to just treat the inflamed tumor environment. We want to treat all three environments. And to do that, the PEF and the intratumoral combination allows us to do that. Now, I would add that a fecal transplant plus immunotherapy is foundational. In fact, I think the literature is really starting to bear out now that if you're going to engage with the immune system, whether that be systemic immunotherapy or intratumoral immunotherapy, and if you don't bring the fecal transplantation and gut microbiome strategy to the front of that, you're creating a substandard therapeutic effect. So you must engage with a fecal transplant to augment the immune system, number one, but also to reverse adverse effects, to basically help patients that come in, as you talked about with your first question, frail, comorbid, heavily pretreated. Well, the gut microbiome is a way to help remedy that. And it's a way to improve the immunotherapy effect as you reduce the side effects and improve quality of life. I think two particular examples of therapeutics that are going to be super exciting that we've been using for many years intradermally is the combination of CD40 and CPG. These are intratumoral immunotherapeutics that are just now starting to show early human data. Now, the problem with most of that is, particularly like with the CD40, when given systemically, again, the problem there is not the drug, the problem's the delivery method. It's too toxic systemically. But when you give it intratumorally, you completely bypass that. And it was a 2025 study showing that it creates tertiary lymphoid structures and actually is generating an intratumoral immune response. And in a study of, I think it was 12 patients, two were lost, 10 patients, of that, two patients complete remission with CD40 intratumoral alone. So we're able to give the proper method with the proper drug at a microdose and now create an immune response. CPG is a toll-like receptor type 9 agonist. And so these, I think, are two combinations that we've been using for quite some time that I think you're really going to start to see take off in the intratumoral approach. But we want to build bridges with our conventional colleagues. And the way we do that is we help what they're doing work better. And the way we do that, research suggests this, is we combine the intratumoral approach with the conventional approach. So doing intratumoral immunotherapy prior to surgery, okay? Now, there was a recent study, it was published in 2025, March, for four different cell culture models where they were actually able to significantly reduce the metastatic and local recurrence, but overall response in terms of destruction of these cells, cultures based on this intratumoral approach by doing it before surgery in these mice. And in fact, looking at the pheochromocytoma cell arm, they were able to 100% eradicate with no recurrence. I mean, 100% no recurrence. So then they try to reintroduce the tumor by engaging the immune system before surgery. They prevented the opportunity for recurrence. In fact, a beautiful review article was published in 2025 in January talking about the need to engage the immune system before surgery. Not saying we don't need surgery, and said, hey, surgery doesn't allow for antigen exposure. It doesn't allow for antigen and immune system training. Let's do that first. Then if you need to do surgical resection, you do that. Now what you've done is you've brought the immune system to the quote-unquote party, the fight, and after this bulk of the tumor is removed, now you've engaged the immune system to go out there and actually look for the smaller areas to target, and you have that tumor burden removed, and you're going to get better results. So by looking at what combination of therapies are we going and where we're seeing, you can see here is just a few examples of where we are and where we're going.
How has patient-driven innovation emphasizing a greater desire to preserve quality of life throughout the course of treatment, how has that impacted clinical practice at Williams Cancer Institute?
Focusing on the patient, and I think where medicine has strayed a little bit is we've gotten focused on a lot of other things other than the patient. I think right now what we need is a restoration of the patient-doctor relationship. Notice I put patient before the doctor. It's been classically called doctor-patient relationship. The purpose by which we all work in medicine is to help the patient. And the whole paternalistic, authoritative role of doctor down to patient, that's no more. It is a side-by-side collaborative relationship. That is what patients demand. And so what we do is we partner with our patients. Now, we empower them through the innovation that we're providing in the practice, but we also provide them empowerment through education. So that process moving forward is helping to recognize what they're demanding, which is quality of life, but treatment success. And so these are dual objectives that we are seeking. And in so doing, what we're showing is that this is not something that you have to wait for. So go through treatment 6 months, 18 months, or however long that is. Hope you make it. Hope the quality of life's not so negatively impacted that you can't recover, then live. No, no, no. What we are seeing based on, for example, that phase one study update that I mentioned, and what we're seeing in clinical experience, and what we're going to see as we expand that out, is that the ability to actually innovate and bring that to patients, we could actually elevate their healing process, elevate their immune system, elevate their quality of life. And at the same time, that empowers the patient to heal themselves at a point where they no longer need us. But we can empower other doctors to help in this process as well. So it's one where we're listening to the patient, we're engaging with the patient on an equal footing, we're listening to them, and we're acting in those arenas of innovate, elevate, empower. And in that, we have the ability to not only just help those quality of lives to get better, but actually preserve them, not later, but now.
Is there anything else that you would like to highlight that we either may not have touched upon, or perhaps something that you'd like to put a little further emphasis on?
Yeah, I think there's two parts. One is the gut microbiome. That area is so exciting, yet it is so preliminary in our understanding, not just in terms of an augmentation of immunotherapy, whether systemic or intratumoral, but also the ability, now that we're understanding that a lot of these tumors have a tumor microbiome. And so we have the ability now to change and engraft in the gut microbiome a way to retool the tumor microbiome to improve treatment response, maybe even deliver treatment. But the best answer to cancer, people go, well, what's the best answer to cancer? They're always thinking about treatment. No, the best answer to cancer is never get it. Never get it. It's prevention. So one of the reasons why we're seeing such a massive shift in the demographics of cancer is because our gut microbiomes are changing. There is a documented extinction event in the My Baby Biome research where 25% of these children at 2 years, following out for 7 years, recruited at 3 to 7 months, they have no bifidobacterium at all. None. That is an extinction event. Now, most people think of that as it relates to the animal world, but that's in our gut microbiome. Now, why is that important? Well, that's how the immune system's primed. So we're not just set up with a legacy of debt. We're set up with a legacy of disease that's not just confined to cancer, but it begins in the gut microbiome. So I believe where we're going is the ability to restore the gut microbiome at such an early state that we can then get the immune system engaged before disease ever starts to develop or even start to go down that road, and change course where what we've been doing is farming P-H-A-R-M-I-N-G disease. We can now actually seed healing by going to the gut microbiome. And so now, not just reacting, but being proactive in prevention, I think that's next level. But also, we're beginning to get involved in research where we're starting to map the microbiome, meaning there's many of us that feel that research supports particular bacteria map the presence and the development of particular tumors. So how we think about tumors, breast cancer, pancreatic cancer, I believe that's going to change, where we're looking at what bacteria are present and how that predicts not only the presence, but also the treatment of the tumor. So mapping the gut microbiome to actually the presence of disease, even beyond just something like colorectal cancer. But then where we're working, as I always say this, we're working on the future of the future. What it sounds like is happening is futuristic. The drive to innovate, to help patients, until we heal every patient with cancer, we must not stop. We can't stop. Patients demand that. We must demand it of ourselves. And so with that, the working of the future is where we're working to transform cells. Now you go, that's crazy. What do you mean transform cells? Well, I mean, animal research shows it's possible. You know, Nobel Prize in Medicine recommendation was, acknowledgement was given in 2012 for the inducible pluripotent stem cells with the Yamanaki factors. Dave and Sid Clare, as it relates to the mice, chimpanzees, and dogs, actually reversing the aging. But aging is just a word, and cancer is just a word. But the hallmarks, as described by the different Sentinel papers there, show that these processes are one and the same. So we can now work to actually heal cells and in terms improve the immune system and transform. Is it possible to transform a cell from a malignant state to a non-malignant state? Well, some really exciting research was done in South Korea, published last year, where they started with a mathematical model and computational model, but carried that in vitro and in vivo and actually showed that it's possible with colorectal cancer cell lines to actually transform these colorectal cancer cells to normal. Now, there's a long way to go to carry that to humans, but you couple all those together, it says, hey, it's possible. And so because it's possible, it demands that we work in that space so that we can take patients that are said to have an impossible diagnosis. This might be the crack of the door to change how we approach cancer, not from one that is a war mentality and war footing, but one that actually heals. And that would get right back to what it means to be a doctor, which means healer, Rafe. And guess what? In so doing, the patient-doctor relationship's restored, and where we're dealing with a crisis of trust, that's going to be reversed. In that push for innovation, we're going to actually help to work to restore medicine to its right place to heal patients and restore the confidence that patients have in medicine, because everybody's out there working to help patients. We just need to do it, I believe, in a different way to achieve that.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcast. The Oncology on the Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network.